This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us today. Death is never an easy topic to discuss, even though it happens to all of us. And it does require some planning, wills to write, final wishes, and funerals to think about before we say our final goodbye. There's also the decision about what to do with your body. While burial has long been a tradition among many religions, more and more people are choosing to be cremated and have their ashes scattered or stored in a place of significance. We discussed the history of cremation when we were joined by Stephen Prothero, professor of religion at Boston University and the author of several best-selling books on religion. His 2002 book, Purified by Fire, A History of Cremation in America, tracked how cremation has been viewed through the ages. Let's take a listen. Looking at your book about the history of cremation, it really seemed to be about the history of sanitation and making burials and bodies in death more sanitary compared to the sort of traditional burial.
That's right. When it starts in the 19th century, and the first one is held in 1876, the reason for it really is public health, and the arguments are advanced mostly by health reformers and by medical doctors who at the time believed that dead bodies piled up in cemeteries let out this, what they called miasma, this sort of dangerous air that caused the sorts of epidemics we saw in the 19th century with cholera and yellow fever and things like that. And we now know that that isn't the case with corpses, but that was a main impulse behind the movement when it began.
Well, the cremation of Baron de Palm, I guess that's the first creation in America, was in Pennsylvania. What part of Pennsylvania?
It was in Washington, Pennsylvania, which is a small town. I guess a little close to Pittsburgh would probably be the closest big city.
And Baron de Palm wanted to be cremated?
That's right. He had come from Bavaria over to the United States and converted or joined this movement called the Theosophical Society, which was one of the main vehicles for Asian religions into the United States in the 19th century. And that group, as part of its effort to popularize Asian religions, particularly Hinduism and Buddhism, decided they wanted also to promote a Asian death rite of cremation. And so he volunteered and said, well, when I die, why don't you go ahead and cremate me?
And that was easier said than done, I guess.
Yeah, well, it was hard because there wasn't a place to do it, and they were convinced they didn't want to do it with an open-air pyre like is still done in India and traditionally done with Hinduism. They wanted it done with this new technology that was being developed in Europe with crematories, essentially, indoors. And they happily found a forward-looking doctor from Washington, Pennsylvania, who had built a crematory on his own property to cremate his own body when he died, and he agreed to cremate the Baron de Palm.
Well, as you said, the kind of first champions of cremation in this country were interested in the kind of science of it, I guess the sanitary nature of it. But as you also write, they seem to be from a certain class, I guess, of American society, and had a certain view towards the immigrant population, towards certain religious denominations. Help us understand who these people were.
Well, I think I refer to them as genteel reformers in the book. They were the kinds of people who we would now say are liberal, you know, who want to improve society by, you know, incorporating new techniques and new ideas, etc. But they also were a little snooty when it came to immigrants who in the 19th century were to a great extent Catholics and Jews who were in favor of burial. And so they sort of pitched their alternative as this progressive, clean, scientific, up-to-date innovation as opposed to the sort of hidebound, traditionalist, backward-looking, Dark Ages kind of folks who insisted on old-fashioned burial.
So the kind of subtext was it you could use it to sort of rid the country of these people once they died?
Yeah, or at least to be cremated was to show that you were what they called an advanced thinker, that you were somehow in some ways a little better than the ordinary folks who buried.
Well, there also was at this time a fear of premature burial. And people were afraid of being buried alive. But there was an interesting argument which you have in your book about, you know, what, is it better to be burned alive or to be buried alive? And the cremation people felt, well, of course, being burned alive would be a better thing to do.
That's right. And it's hard to know how much of this discussion in the 19th century about premature burial is really history and how much of it is fiction. You know, we have, obviously, you know, short story by Edgar Allan Poe about being buried alive, and it is a gruesome idea to contemplate. But the reality is that there were people who really were buried alive, that it was much harder in the 19th century to know when someone was dead. Now we have sophisticated techniques with you know, brain scans and heart monitors and things like that, where we can really know with much greater certainty when someone's dead, as opposed to, say, when they're in a coma. And they knew from exhumed bodies that they found in the 19th century that there were people who had been buried alive, who had tried to claw and scratch their way out of coffins. And a number of the early innovators with cremation had either a friend or a family member who they believed was had been buried alive, and they really didn't want that to happen to them. And they said, well, look, if I'm cremated alive, that'll last a second, and if I'm buried alive, I might be there, you know, for 4 or 5 days with this gruesome psychological experience.
And we actually, Stephen, had a pretty interesting conversation, the producers of Radio Times and myself this morning before the show, where we all were talking about, you know, do we want to be buried? Do we want to be cremated? And I think it's perhaps a less taboo subject than it used to be. It was pretty interesting to sort of see how people sort of played that out for themselves.
Well, why do you want to be cremated?
I like the idea of being pulverized and sprinkled. I haven't picked my spot yet, but sprinkled somewhere in a place that I love. And I like the sort of dust-to-dust idea of that. I don't believe in the afterlife. And I like the sort of rituals that you can create around that, and even the symbolism of going back to that sort of pulverized nothingness,
right?
Where you know, I assume we all started in some way,
right?
How about you?
I haven't really decided yet.
You wrote a whole book on it, and you haven't decided.
I haven't really decided. Right now, it's up to my wife. If I die, she can decide what to do with me.
Well,
I don't have very strong feelings either way. But that interest in sort of going back to nature that you articulate there is a real driver for a lot of people. They really like that idea of ashes to ashes, dust to dust, and being scattered somewhere out in nature and returning to that state.
Well, let me just read a couple of lines. Actually, this is from the introduction to your book about why this really matters. You write, whether to bury or to burn is no trivial matter. It touches on issues as important as perceptions of the self, attitudes towards the body, views of history, styles of ritual, and beliefs in God and the afterlife. Do we owe our principal allegiance to the dead or to the living or to the not yet born? Is the body a temple or a tomb? Am I my mind? Am I my body? Or a messy mix of the two? Is there an afterlife? If so, is it for bodies or for souls or for both? And does it begin in all its glory immediately upon death or at some future moment of apocalypse, resurrection, or judgment? I mean, it seems to me there are no more basic questions than the ones that you raise in that paragraph.
Well, I think that's right. And one argument of the book is that there is a real intimate connection between the views that people have of themselves in terms of, is the body really part of the self or is it external? The views they have of the afterlife, and then the views they have about death and burial. I mean, it was interesting when I asked you why you wanted to be cremated. You said, you know, I don't believe in the afterlife, and that was part of your way of thinking about it. And I think if you believe in the resurrection of the body, for example, then the idea of being buried and being in a coffin and sort of waiting, death becomes this sort of in-between state. It's between this life and then the resurrected body life, and you are going to be put back together. Your soul somehow is going to reconnect with your body in the afterlife. It makes sense for you to not cremate and to be sitting there and sort of waiting. And, you know, the traditional Jewish and Christian view is at the end of times, you know, the bodies are just going to be called up, trumpeted out of the earth. If you have a more Greek or Hindu view, and this view is becoming more popular and just in mainstream America, that the person is really essentially spiritual and the body is external to the to the self, and that maybe there's a reincarnation, or then the notion of cremation works. It frees up the body to move on to take another body in another life.
Well, let's go from the spiritual to the hardcore secular, and David raised this notion about cremations being cheaper. Is it that much cheaper than a burial?
Well,
traditional burial?
As a rule, in general, it is cheaper, and it can be done quite inexpensively if you do what is called direct cremation, where someone comes and picks up the body, and they take it to a crematory, and then they return a week later with, you know, a cardboard box with ashes. That's pretty cheap. But the reality is that you can do cremation as cheap or as expensive as you want. Mm. And one reason why the opposition to cremation among funeral directors has abated over the last 5 or 10 years is that funeral directors have learned that there's a lot of money in cremations as well. There's people who choose urns that cost $2,000 and cremation caskets that cost $5,000 and who choose to have full-blown funerals and et cetera. So I think one of the misnomers about cremation is that people choose it for the money. But in general, people don't cremate because it's inexpensive. Mm-hmm. People who are poor and arguably, you know, ought to be concerned about the cost of death rites, they tend to bury. And people who are wealthier tend to cremate. And I don't think people say, well, I can save $1,000, I'll cremate. I think that's actually fairly rare. I think the reasons for cremation are more cultural and spiritual rather than economic.
Is there also a land issue? I was reading in England, as you found, something like 25% of Americans now choose cremation, but I think in England it's something like 70%. And I don't know if that's true for the rest of the world or even the rest of Europe, whether the U.S., I guess, lags behind when it comes to cremation. First of all, is that true?
Well, there's huge variation across countries. The countries like England that have essentially taken it on as a national policy, where the crematories are run by the government, have really made cremation the norm. There are other countries too where, for cultural reasons, cremation is the norm. So in India or in Japan, for example, the United States, in religion and in death rites, we have a free market system where you kind of can pick your own religion and pick your own death rite. And so we are behind countries like England, but we're way ahead of countries like France. So I think the story isn't so much that 25% is a huge number. The story is that we've had an incredible change in the last 25 years, where we've gone very rapidly to cremation, and that's quite surprising in an area like funerals and death rites, which tend to be really resistant to change.
That was my 2002 conversation with religion expert Stephen Prothero about his book Purified by Fire, The History of Cremation in America. This is Radio Times in Review, and when we get back from the break, we'll hear how the nation mourned the death of Abraham Lincoln following his assassination. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. America has had 4 presidential assassinations. The first one, that of Abraham Lincoln, has reverberated for more than 150 years. Historian Martha Hodes delved deep into many primary sources, including diaries and letters, to take the temperature of the national sentiment in the immediate aftermath of Lincoln's death. That's what she wrote about in her book, Mourning Lincoln, that just won the Gilder Lehrman Lincoln Prize for, quote, the finest scholarly work in English on Abraham Lincoln. She joined us last year to discuss Lincoln's death. Let's take a listen. Would you say that shock was the dominant reaction? Because we're talking about the first president murdered in office, and we're also talking about something that happened so close after the end of the Civil War.
Yes, absolutely. The major response, or the most pervasive response, was shock. And that included people who loved Lincoln and people who despised Lincoln. But people who loved Lincoln especially wrote in their diaries, wrote in their letters, that it was absolutely stupefying, astounding, amazing. A thunderclap from a clear blue sky is a phrase you often hear. People often invoked strange weather patterns to describe their moods. They were struck with horror. They were struck with grief. They called it a calamity, a catastrophe, a dagger to the heart. All of those kinds of phrases and words conveyed the shock people felt.
Do you think that grief was so profound because so many people in this country had lost someone, either killed or perhaps even more, even wounded from the Civil War?
Yes, just as you said, 750,000 deaths from the Civil War, 2% of the population. Just to translate that into present-day terms, that would mean 7 million lives lost today. So almost everybody knew somebody who had died in the Civil War, whether father or husband, son, brother, friend, or neighbor. People thought of Lincoln in some ways as the last casualty of the Civil War. That wasn't literally true because people kept dying. Soldiers were dying in hospitals and at camp and at home from wounds they'd received. But people thought of Lincoln symbolically. His death was symbolically the last death. And people combined their grief for Lincoln with their grief for their loved ones. And so often in diaries or letters, I would find people writing about Lincoln's assassination and then adding a line like, 2 years ago today, my dear son died in the war.
Mm. What I've found from your book, and there are many things that I learned from your book, is that there wasn't a northern response and a southern response to Lincoln's death. It was a much more complex response than that. And perhaps, you know, we naively think that the country was so evenly divided along those lines, but clearly it wasn't.
Yes, that's exactly right. So in the South, you have white Southerners and black Southerners, and they're fighting on different sides of the war. So Confederates respond to Lincoln's assassination with a certain amount of glee. Partly it's just a relief from the horror of surrender and defeat. Southern African Americans, former slaves, people who have recently been freed, are utterly devastated. And then in the North, most people are Lincoln supporters and most people are overcome with grief, but there is a significant minority of Lincoln's antagonists, the so-called Copperheads. They were the members of the Northern Democratic Party. They had been named after a poisonous snake by their enemies. And they also responded, like the Confederates, with glee at Lincoln's assassination.
As you say, glee, but really, I mean, glee in all its glory, right?
Yes.
Kind of reveling in his death.
Yes, that's exactly right. Confederates are a really interesting case because they do revel in Lincoln's assassination. And they say things like, oh, one soldier wrote in his diary, pity it hadn't been done years ago. Mm. And people write things like, bully for Booth. But at the same time, Confederates are very trepidatious. They're very fearful of what's going to happen next. And in some ways, they consider Lincoln someone who would have been good to them after surrender. I at first thought that that idea that Lincoln was the best friend of the South was something that developed later with a kind of lost cause narrative. But I found that sentiment that very day, the day of Lincoln's death. So Confederate responses are both gleeful for the moment, just for the moment, as a reprieve from defeat, but also fearful in the end. And the Copperheads in the North, they supported a war for union, but they hated a war for slavery. And so their responses to Lincoln were in many ways based in racism and were very joking and jovial. So one man said, for example, after Booth shot Lincoln in the head, he has as much brains now as he ever had. So those kinds of jokes infuriated Lincoln's mourners.
And for blacks and slaves or former slaves, I'm assuming that they were afraid that there would be a return of slavery.
Yes, very interesting. So African Americans had been very critical of Lincoln during the war because he had been slow to act on emancipation. But Lincoln had been deeply influenced by African Americans, by black abolitionists and their white allies during the war. And of course, he had eventually issued the Emancipation Proclamation. He had delivered the second inaugural address when he was elected 6 weeks before he was assassinated, in which he had stated clearly that the war was a war about slavery. And he had stated in that address that God wouldn't let the war end until slavery ended. So African Americans were devastated, fearful, and the example you gave is interesting. I found a document in which a six-year-old boy in the South asked his teacher, who was a Northern missionary, does this mean we have to be slaves again? And no doubt he was echoing what grown-ups around him had said.
Let's talk about Mary Todd Lincoln. And as you write in this book, everything sort of about her at that time was poor Mrs. Lincoln. Poor Mrs. Lincoln. And one can understand the devastation that she experienced. How did she mourn her husband?
Well, you're absolutely right that many of the diaries and letters I wrote use that exact phrase, poor Mrs. Lincoln. People felt terrible for her. And indeed, she had experienced the trauma of witnessing, sitting right next to her husband when he was shot in the booth at Ford's Theater. Today, we would say she suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm. She had also lost two sons during the war, one in 1859 and one in 1862, little boys. What's interesting about Mary Todd Lincoln's response is that many mourners made the statement that they felt as if the world had come to a halt. But in fact, for most people, that wasn't true. They kept on with their daily lives. For Mary Todd Lincoln, the world really did come to a halt in that she went into the White House. She shut herself up in a bedroom, not the bedroom she had shared with the president. She couldn't stand to be in there. And she did not come out for a long time. She did not attend the funeral in Washington. She didn't ride the funeral train. She didn't attend his burial in Springfield, Illinois. She really was so devastated, she would permit only a few close friends to come in and see her. So she really was deeply, deeply traumatized and unable to face the future.
Which tells us a lot about their relationship, if I can use a very 21st century, or about their marriage.
Well, they did have, Lincoln's had a complicated relationship, yes. And many scholars and many people have blamed Mary Lincoln for being shrewish or for spending too much money. And while some of that may be true, whatever happened to her after the assassination, I think we have to understand in light of what she had experienced in the loss of her husband.
It feels like the official mourning period went on for several months just because of the time it took to for the news to spread.
Yes. I mean, the most immediate mourning period was the 2 weeks between the assassination and then the burial of Lincoln on May 4th, 1865. But all through that time, at different stages, people in different places were getting the news. And so, for example, I have letters written by the U.S. ambassador to Egypt, and he got the news much, much later, weeks later. And he would write in his letters, I feel this has just happened right now. Mm-hmm. So he was repeating all the grief and shock that everyone back in the United States had felt such a long time ago.
Let's talk a bit about his funeral and then the funeral procession that took about 12 days. You have a piece in the New York Times today about what happened to Lincoln's body as it went from town to town. It came through Philadelphia, for instance. It seems like by the time it got to its burial place, he didn't look particularly presidential.
Yes, that's right. So Lincoln's body was carried after the funeral in Washington, which took place on April 19th. Lincoln's body was carried on a 2 weeks, nearly 1,700-mile journey across the northern states to be buried in his hometown of Springfield, Illinois. And of course, in 1865, the art of embalming was quite rudimentary. And so although doctors had tried to preserve Lincoln, the decay set in quite quickly. And what that meant was that people were very eager for a glimpse of Lincoln's body and Lincoln's face. It was one of the ways to make the assassination seem real after the shock of the news. And so perhaps a million people across the country filed by Lincoln's coffin. I should say that the body was removed from the train at 11 separate destinations for 11 separate cities and their funerals in those particular cities. So there were many funerals for President Lincoln. But as you were saying, Marty, his face began to shrink. The skin began to darken. That's what happened when skin begins to decay. And so a number of the sources that I read, quite a few of the sources that I read, made the point that you were talking about, that he didn't look very presidential. He didn't look, one man said, he didn't look as we expected great men to look. And some people stepped out of the line and said, you know, I'd rather remember Lincoln as I saw him, say, at the second inaugural, or giving a speech with a beautiful smile on his lips, realizing that what they saw in the coffin didn't feel like Lincoln's spirit.
You have a really interesting chapter. In fact, it's titled God. And I guess how people interpreted perhaps the war, perhaps slavery, and certainly Lincoln himself as they were living their own faith. Interestingly, he was shot on a Good Friday, died the next day. How were the various interpretations of perhaps Lincoln's assassination interpreted through the lens of God?
Well, people really struggled spiritually, and that was what was so interesting to me. So Lincoln was shot on Good Friday, he died the next day, and the day after that was Easter Sunday. Mm. So, of course, people expect to go to church on Easter Sunday and hear a joyful sermon. And, of course, the ministers had written joyful sermons and had to rewrite them in some way preserving the joy of Easter, but also reckoning with what had happened. People went to church with one enormous question on their minds. Why had God let this happen? Mm. This was just after Union victory, so the victors felt sure that God had orchestrated Union victory, and now they could not imagine why God had taken Lincoln away at this moment. And so what ministers told their congregations, and the ministers were struggling too, by the way, because I read their diaries and letters as well. They tried to make the case that God's will was mysterious, but the fact that he had taken Lincoln away when he did gave greater meaning. Somehow God's plan was more meaningful than human beings could ever understand. And people went home and wrote that in their diaries. This is what the minister said. But they still weren't quite sure, and they were still really struggling with that question.
I mean, was it trying to deify him, or did people come away with this, you know, the sort of right, especially on Easter weekend, the sort of rising from the dead?
Well, Lincoln was deified, and Lincoln was deified, I would say, instantly. I wondered if that was something that happened later. But again, Saturday morning, April 15th, people compared Lincoln to George Washington, although that was something white mourners did and black mourners did not do, since George Washington was a slaveholder. Mm. Then people compared Lincoln to Moses, and then people compared Lincoln to Jesus. And that was Moses and Jesus were both black and white mourners. And people would write things, African Americans would say things like, next to Jesus, Lincoln is the greatest person who ever lived. So they would, you know, make him maybe one step down, but that comparison was definitely in people's minds and hearts.
You do include two really interesting speeches in your book that Frederick Douglass gave. The first, I believe, was June 1st, 1865, and this was near, I guess, the end of the mourning period for Lincoln. He says, "No people or class of people in the country have a better reason for lamenting the death of Abraham Lincoln and for desiring to honor and perpetuate his memory than have the colored people." And he goes on to say that Lincoln was a black man's president. How important was that speech?
Well, Frederick Douglass is such an important character in this drama and in the history of the Civil War. Douglass was not uncritical of Lincoln during the war. He did push Lincoln to be more radical on abolition and on the issue of slavery. But when Lincoln was assassinated, Douglass recognized that Lincoln had come a long way, that he had been influenced by black abolitionists, by Frederick Douglass himself. And Douglass made the point that Lincoln was an honorable anti-slavery man and that his loss was a tremendous loss for African Americans. He used the phrase unspeakable calamity, and that's quite a forceful phrase. Douglass also made the point that slavery would not be abolished until the black man has the vote. That's how he put it. And his point there was that had Lincoln lived, Douglass believed, Lincoln would have listened to African Americans. He would have considered what they needed to do, what he needed to do in order for African Americans to move beyond mere freedom to acquire citizenship, voting rights, land, education. That's not what happened under Lincoln's successor, and Douglass was quite aware of that.
Did his assassination elevate him? I mean, he is considered to be one of our greatest presidents, and I think that probably would still stand, but he was a martyr as well. And do you think that elevated his status?
It certainly did. The unknown to that question is what would have happened had Lincoln lived, because that, of course, would have determined his reputation for the rest of his life and beyond. So we don't know how Lincoln would have responded, how he would have reconstructed the country. We only have hints here and there. But we do know one thing, and this also comes from Frederick Douglass. We know that Lincoln would have handled Reconstruction in a way much more favorable to African Americans than did Andrew Johnson, his successor. And after the assassination, African Americans went to the White House and petitioned Andrew Johnson. They had a real sense that he was not going to be their friend. And they said to him things like, think about what your noble predecessor would have done. Mm. So they invoked Lincoln specifically as a model for Johnson to follow, and Johnson did not follow that model.
I mean, were there conspiracy? I mean, there seems like there always are conspiracy theories, but were there particular ones at this time?
Yes. So people wanted to find somebody to blame for Lincoln's assassination. I mean, certainly Booth was the first line of blame, but people who were mourning Lincoln, unlike Confederates who wanted to prove that Booth was a lone madman, Lincoln's mourners did not think that he had acted alone. And they blamed both the Confederate leadership, and then they blamed what they called the Southern system, which was slavery. So they made the point that slavery had murdered Lincoln. But the prosecutor in the trial of the conspirators wanted to prove that the Confederate leadership had been behind the assassination, and he was never able to prove that. There are still scholars and some historians, although it's not the dominant view by any means, who believe there was a larger Confederate conspiracy that's never been proven behind Booth's act.
One of the things that got you thinking about how the country mourned Abraham Lincoln was being in New York City on September 11th and being there also in the aftermath of that, you know, horrible, tragic day.
Yes. And in many ways, I trace my writing this book and my interest in the assassination to being in New York during 9/11. And I was very young during Kennedy's assassination. I was 5 years old, so I have memories of that as well. But what we remember as a moment of universal grief and devastation, what I realized when I thought back on 9/11, I remembered it as a moment of universal grief and devastation. And then I went back to some photographs that I had taken. I had walked through the streets of New York on the morning of September 12th, and I had photographed signs that people had written and stuck up and the various shrines that they had made. And there was just as much tension and contention in those signs. So there were people who called for peace, people who called for revenge, people who defaced the signs that called for peace with calls for war, people who scrawled on signs to distrust the media. So it was a moment certainly of shock and grief, absolutely, but also a moment of complication, confusion, tension, contention. And then that's what I realized was also happening at the moment of Lincoln's assassination.
That was my conversation with Martha Hodes about her award-winning book, Mourning Lincoln. This is Radio Times in Review, and when we get back from the break, we'll hear from Michael Pollan, whose book, Cooked, was just turned into a mini-series and will be made available this evening on Netflix. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us. Americans are cooking less and watching people cook more. This is what sparked food and culture writer Michael Pollan to write his book Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. It's an in-depth analysis of the way Americans have changed their cooking and eating habits over the years and why we might benefit from taking cues from other cultures and countries. Cook was turned into a 4-part docuseries and will be made available on Netflix this evening. Pollan joined us in 2013 upon the publication of his best-selling book, in which we discussed fire, water, air, and earth. Let's take a listen. Well, it's interesting that you have written about growing food, you've written about eating food, and now you're writing about cooking food. Was that the piece that was missing for you?
As it turned out, I didn't realize it when I set out. I don't kind of plan my books very carefully, but I started out writing about the food chain, and you know, Omnivore's Dilemma is really a story about where your food is grown and how it's produced. And then I leapt ahead because everybody was saying, well, what about health? What about health? And I took a look at the body end of the food chain. You know, what happens after we ingest this stuff? What does it do to our health? Why do we suffer from so much chronic disease and obesity? And along the way, I kept bumping into cooking or the lack thereof as having a profound impact on both ends of the food chain. So that the reason that we've industrialized our agriculture and moved to these giant monocultures, whether of corn and soy or animal factories, is really because fast food has been driving those kind of changes. The industrialization of our eating is leading to the industrialization of our growing of food. And so I realized, oh, that's interesting. You kind of have to pay attention to the eating and not just the farming. And then when I was working on the nutrient question, what should you eat, mm-hmm. it gradually became clear that it really didn't matter what nutrients you ate. What mattered most is a human doing your cooking or a corporation? And if a corporation's cooking for you, odds are you're eating the wrong stuff and you're eating too much of it and you're going to have problems with chronic disease and all the dietary problems we're seeing.
And you're also describing a kind of food haves and have-nots, because on the one hand, yes, We eat out much more than we used to. We eat a lot of fast food that we didn't used to do. But we also, for many people, and this is probably more middle class and upper middle class people, have nice kitchens full of, you know, mixers and specialized dishwashers. Yeah. It's a sort of a weird dichotomy
when it
comes
paradox.
To food.
We're kind of obsessed with cooking. And it's true. Lots of rich people have these show kitchens, which they barely use, but it's an important status symbol. And we also watch lots of cooking on television. And there are millions of Americans who are spending more minutes in the day watching other people cook food on television than they are spending cooking it themselves.
Really? Yeah.
Well, the average American is spending 27 minutes a day cooking. One episode of a Food Network show gets you over that. And many people watch several at once. So that, in a way, was a paradox that got me thinking about this whole question. If we decided to outsource cooking, like so many other things in modern life, to corporations, why are we looking back? Why don't we just – I mean, we outsource changing the oil in your car. We outsource sewing your clothing. There's so many things we don't do ourselves anymore, and we haven't looked back. Cooking's different, and I was kind of curious to unpack that and figure out why. Why is cooking different? And I think partly because it goes really deep into who we are. We all have really warm memories of being in the kitchen as kids, whether it was our mother or our grandmother, and the smells and the transformations that take place, the alchemy, and then this gift of the home cooked food prepared by someone who loves you. And I think we're not quite prepared to let it go, even those of us who feel we don't have time or we don't have skills.
But it's interesting to think about what happened to women in the kitchen. You write about the feminist movement and, you know, getting out of the kitchen, going to work, and what happened to cooking under that. I think there was a KFC ad that you include saying.
Yeah, well, the industry basically
kind of tapped into all of that.
Saw what was going on. They recognized that there was this uncomfortable conversation taking place in American kitchens and, you know, dinner tables over this, we need to redo the division of labor in the house because women are working now. It isn't fair that women should still be responsible for all the domestic chores. And in fact, women liked cooking better than all the other domestic chores. The marketers knew this. They saw it as a creative outlet. It wasn't regarded as drudgery.
Than dusting.
All the cleaning really was. The laundry was. But the industry leapt in and they saw an opportunity. They'd been trying to get into the American kitchen for 100 years and they'd been rebuffed more or less. But when this tension arose and the feminist revolution came, they stepped forward and KFC had a billboard that basically captured this marketing genius. It was a big bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken with two words over it, women's liberation. And they successfully kind of re-described not cooking as a progressive thing to do.
Yeah.
And it worked. And it relieved this tension in the household. And we find, you know, cooking rates dropping by half since 1977, the amount of time and the number of meals that are cooked at home.
Well, it's interesting to think about time because I think everyone feels like they don't have any. And also technology, what technology has offered all of us.
Well, you know, we have a lot of time-saving technologies, but we feel more time pressure than ever. So there's something wrong with this picture. But I'm convinced – I mean, we do have a time problem. There's no question about it. But we have a lot more media making claims on our time. And if you look at how we're spending time, we say we have no time. But in the last 10 years alone, we found 2 hours a day for the internet. Where do we get it? It's still a 24-hour day. Well, we took some of it from television watching. We took some of it probably from cooking. The point is, I think, that if we think something's important, we find the time. The difference is you can outsource cooking. You can't outsource taking a run or going to the gym.
Well, and you also argue that literally by cooking at home, you are making steps to improve your health.
Yeah. I mean, I've studied nutrition closely for the last couple of years. And based on the research I've read and also based on the uncertainty about nutrients, good and bad, and the changing advice about that, the most important thing you can do for your health is to cook. If you cook, you don't have to worry about nutrients anymore. You don't have to know what an antioxidant is. You're going to cook the right stuff. Corporations cook very differently than human beings do. in a couple different ways. First, they shop badly. They buy the cheapest stuff they can find, cheap commodities. Then they dress it up with lots of salt, fat, and sugar to make it bearable and attractive to us.
And we love those tastes.
They do. Yeah, and they're cheap. They're very cheap to provide. Sugar and salt are, you know, incredibly cheap to provide. And then they use lots of additives, really dubious additives, because this stuff was cooked a long time ago and far away, and it has to have a good shelf life. So they're using chemicals to prepare these foods that you would never have in your own pantry. And there are real questions about their health value and their effect on our kids especially. But the other thing about corporate cooking is they cook different kinds of food. They love to cook those labor-intensive foods that are made with cheap, raw ingredients. That's their perfect food. And, of course, the French fry is their best achievement.
I have to give them credit.
One thing they cook well are French fries. And once you cook French fries in a factory, they're so easy to make. But imagine you're a home cook and you're cooking most of your own food. You'll only make French fries once a month, every 2 months. It's really hard and messy. Whereas if you're letting corporations cook, you could have it twice a day. And many, many Americans do eat French fries twice a day. And that's precisely the kinds of foods we're getting in trouble with.
Your book begins with a trip to a place called the Skylight Inn in Aden, North Carolina, to find out how they make barbecue. And it sounds like it tastes really, really good.
It was really good. Well, I was looking for the kind of most unreconstructed cooking there is, the closest thing to that ancient put an animal over the fire and share it experience, right, which is, you know, where cooking begins. And so in the fire section, which is really about the early origins of cooking and recapturing some of that primal magic, I thought, well, whole hog barbecue, which is the specialty of Eastern North Carolina. Eastern is whole hog, vinegar-based sauce, very little sauce. And so I found a couple pit masters, and I went out to Aden. That was the first place I went. And this place was in the middle of nowhere. It was this really funky building that had a Capitol dome on it for obscure reasons and was called the Skylight Inn but had no skylight. And they were cooking whole hogs in a brick building behind the restaurant that had actually burned down 3 or 4 times because, you know, they have to leave the fire running all night and nobody sticks around. And they were slow cooking these pigs, 20 hours each, over wood fire, just smoldering gently, 200 degrees. And then they would chop it all together. I mean, that's what's unusual about a whole hog barbecue. You're not getting the loin or the shoulder or the belly. You're getting everything chopped together with the crackling. And that's the magic ingredient. It's like these little shards of bacon only begins to suggest how good it is. And they chop it all together and they put it on a bun. And they mix a little vinegar and pepper with it. And it's an astonishing sandwich.
And it costs $2.75.
Which is amazing. I mean, this is a very democratic slow food when you think about it. However, the only way they can do it that cheaply is by using commodity pork, which is a nasty product in my view. I mean, it comes off of these confinement operations that are essentially destroying agriculture and the environment in Eastern North Carolina.
But just to underscore a pig farm that you visited, and I'm just quoting you here, you do describe it, and I think it's important for listeners to understand this, a porcine hell of stench and shrieking. I mean, it sounds like a horror.
Well, confinement hog operations, which are indoors, the animals are penned, the sows are in pens so narrow they can never turn around to make it easier to inseminate them. They all have their tails clipped. To make them more sensitive so that they will shriek when other animals try to cannibalize them because they're going crazy. It is a hell. It's a vision of hell to be in one of these places. And it's very hard, having been in one of those places, to enjoy normal pork.
Let me ask you about the water chapter. And you had actually, she was a student of yours, and then you became a student of hers, an Iranian-American, Samin Nosrat.
Yeah.
And she has worked, I guess, at Chez Panisse.
She trained at Chez Panisse and then had worked in another restaurant. The second chapter is about water, which is to say cooking in pots, everyday home cooking. As she calls it, grandma cooking. We fetishize it now, but this is how peasants fed themselves with really cheap cuts of meat, which are the best for braising and stewing. They have the most flavor, and they respond to long cooking. But you also mix vegetables in, so you're having less meat in your diet, basically. Meat becomes the flavor medium. But a lot of the bulk is vegetables. So it's a very sustainable way to eat on many levels. Plus, there's absolutely no loss of nutrients. You know, whereas if you're grilling, all the fat and lots of nutrients are dripping onto the fire and you're losing them. In a pot, it's all contained. And then you have this miracle of people eating from the same pot, which psychologically is very
like
powerful.
Like a pot in the middle of the
yeah,
table?
Yeah, you put the trivet out and you actually bring the casserole out. And the you know, fragrant steam comes out and people come out of their rooms. They're like, what do I smell? And they gravitate to the table. And I'm convinced when people share food, they find themselves on the same emotional page in a way we never do if we're all getting our
single-serving
entrees.
Let me ask you about bread because that's the air part of this book. You call baking the carpentry of cooking.
That's,
I like that.
I was intimidated because it seemed like that. It seemed like compared to cooking, which had this margin of error, it did seem like architecture or carpentry. It had to be really precise.
Things had to work out, right?
Yeah, and you know, you had to buy a scale, calibrated in grams. That was really, you know, metric. I mean, that was really intimidating. And baker's math is very intimidating, too. They have a whole system for writing recipes that's different than anyone else on the planet. But as I learned how to do it, and again, working side by side with somebody, I realized you could throw all that out and trust your senses. That once you understood what you were going for in dough, you could tell when it was getting billowy and properly fermented. You could smell the changes in your starter and know whether your starter was healthy or needed to be fed. You could taste how sour the dough had gotten and whether it was time to stop the fermentation and put it in the oven. So it turns out to be less like carpentry than I thought and more like gardening.
Which you do, right?
Which I do, and I'm much more comfortable with. And gardening is not for precision types. You know, it's a dialogue, and there's plenty of adjustment. And if something dies, you just kind of, you know, throw it out and start again. It's not like – I mean, I wrote a book about architecture, and you make a mistake in your foundation, and you're screwed for the rest of the history of the building. So as it turns out, baking is more forgiving than I thought and much more to my liking than I expected.
Let me ask you about Michelle Obama. And she certainly has talked about getting fit and eating fresh and having a garden at the White House. Do you think – is there more that you want her to say about cooking per se?
I think it would be great if she talked about cooking. I think she has a little problem talking about cooking in that she doesn't do it.
She doesn't have to.
Well,
right?
Yeah,
she has a
superb chef, and she's a very busy person, and it's pretty rare that people in the White House do their own cooking for that period of time. But I think she appreciates the importance of it. Her chef, in fact, Sam Cass, is a great advocate for home cooking and does a lot to promote that himself. But yeah, I mean, I think the power of first ladies is to change the culture, not to change policy so much. And I think Michelle Obama has started the process of trying to change the culture of food in this country by going to farmers markets, planting a garden, talking about real food. But I also feel that her message has been somewhat diluted because her other initiative has been to negotiate tweaks in processed food. And I understand why she's doing that. And once the food industry comes to you and they say, we want to help, you can't, as First Lady, tell them to get lost.
But would you say that the industrialized food system that we so rely on really is unsustainable as we look into the future, whether it has to do with land or air
or health
or
without question.
Global warming?
If we're still eating the same way and growing food the same way in 50 years, there will be a breakdown of one kind or another.
That was my conversation with food and culture writer Michael Pollan. His book, Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation, was turned into a docuseries and is being made available tonight on Netflix. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Artie Moscowain. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.